As you can determine from the preceding simulation, the multiple encounter is not as difficult to manage as you might expect. There are two reasons why this is so. First, while the candidate controls individual patient management, the examiner moves the candidate from one patient to the next in a timely fashion, thus facilitating the management of three cases simultaneously. And second, in the multiple encounter situation, emphasis is on diagnosis and early management. There is less detail to worry about because the examiner is interested in your ability to quickly diagnose problems and initiate appropriate management in a timely fashion. Now let's analyze these cases one at a time. The first patient, Tommy Wilson, had an acute asthma attack. The single critical action in this case was administration of sympathomimetic therapy. Other appropriate actions included the following. 1. Applies pulse oximeter. 2. Administers supplemental O2. 3. Checks peak expiratory flow rate. And 4. Administers steroids. For the purposes of the exam, the presentation of the asthma patient may vary. The problem may be rather straightforward in its presentation, such as this one was, or it may be complicated by a respiratory tract infection or pneumothorax. Another possible scenario is the chronic asthmatic who is steroid dependent and presents with status asthmaticus. My point is this: keep an open mind in dealing with the asthma patient. You may be dealing with a simple problem that can be corrected in the emergency department and the patient can be sent home. Or you may be dealing with a more complicated problem requiring precise determination of the degree of airway obstruction and aggressive pharmacologic management. These patients usually require admission. As you listened to this case being presented, you heard the examiner making gasping sounds in an attempt to imitate the wheezing sound. The examiners often do this at the exam. If you're not sure what you are hearing, ask the examiner, just as this candidate did when he said, "Is Tommy wheezing?" If the examiner had said no, then the next question might be, "Is this stridor?" Thus pointing to epiglottitis rather than asthma. The candidate's management of the asthmatic child was inefficient. An inadequate history was obtained during the initial assessment. At that time, the only information obtained was that the child had a history of asthma. Later on, he learned that Proventil syrup had been prescribed. And later still, he inquired about the prior use of steroids. All of this information and more should have been obtained in the initial assessment. A good short history might be the following. Does he have asthma? When did this attack start? What medications has he been taking, and has he been taking them as prescribed? Has he ever taken steroids? What does it usually take to clear him? Has he ever been hospitalized or intubated for his asthma? How bad is this attack compared with previous ones? Does he have high blood pressure or heart disease? Your initial approach to the asthmatic child should include an assessment of his oxygen saturation. Pulse oximetry is an excellent non-invasive tool for determining this. It can be used to establish the patient's baseline oxygen saturation and to monitor his response to therapy. ABGs are rarely needed. The assessment should be followed by the administration of supplemental O2. Almost all asthmatics have some degree of hypoxia, and the aggressive use of beta-adrenergic agents can initially worsen this hypoxemia by increasing the ventilation-perfusion mismatch. Next, pulmonary function testing should be performed. The test of choice in the emergency department is the peak expiratory flow rate. With careful instruction, most children can perform this test by the age of 5. The peak expiratory flow rate provides a quantitative assessment of the degree of airflow obstruction. While the initial measurement provides information about the severity of the attack, subsequent measurements provide an objective assessment of the child's response to therapy. Since peak expiratory flow rates vary with the child's height, you will probably need to refer to a nomogram to know what the predicted peak expiratory flow rate is for any given child. This should be followed by the administration of a sympathomimetic agent, the therapy of choice for initial management of acute exacerbations of asthma. Aerosolized administration of these agents via nebulization or a metered dose inhaler with a spacer is the preferred method of delivery. Compared with parenteral therapy, inhalation therapy is associated with superior bronchodilation, a more rapid onset of action, and fewer systemic side effects. Albuterol is the preferred agent due to its beta-2 agonist specificity. It may be given every 20 minutes and even continuously as tolerated during the initial stabilization period. Subcutaneous administration of beta-adrenergic agents such as epinephrine or terbutaline is currently reserved for infants and children who are too sick to provide the necessary inspiratory effort. It is important to monitor the response after each treatment, or every 20 minutes if continuous nebulization is being used. Auscultatory findings, respiratory rate and pulse should be assessed in every patient. Signs of clinical improvement in the child who remains alert and looks better are improved air exchange, resolution of wheezing and retractions, and normalization of the respiratory rate. Tachycardia is a usual response to adrenergic agents. As long as the rate is not excessive, it's nothing to worry about. Oxygen saturation and peak expiratory flow rates should also be followed. Now that you have administered albuterol and monitored the patient's response, where do you go from here? Children who respond well to inhalation therapy alone may be discharged on an oral or inhaled beta-adrenergic agent, depending on their age. Younger children do well with an oral agent, while children 6 years of age or more can, with training, use a metered dose inhaler with a spacer. Corticosteroids are being used earlier and with greater frequency than in the past. When administered early, along with the initial albuterol therapy, they prevent progression of the attack and decrease the rate of relapse. Steroids should be given to all children with moderate to severe exacerbations, as well as those with mild exacerbations who fail to clear completely with initial albuterol therapy, and those who have recently discontinued an oral steroid preparation. Steroids are essential in treating the inflammatory component of asthma. They also increase the number and sensitivity of beta receptors and inhibit the migration and function of eosinophils and neutrophils. However, the absorption of liquid prednisone and prednisolone is less than 30 minutes. So, unless the patient is vomiting or in severe distress, there is no advantage to IV administration. Patients who receive steroids in the emergency department and are subsequently discharged should be continued on an oral agent at a dose of 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day for 3 to 10 days. Ipratropium bromide, when used in combination with inhaled or parenteral beta-adrenergic agonists, exhibit an additive effect. In children with severe exacerbations, ipratropium should be added to the first 3 albuterol treatments, or every 20 minutes for an hour if therapy is continuous. The dose is 250 micrograms in 2 cc's normal saline. This topic, pediatric asthma, is also discussed in the 6th CD. You'll find some of this repetitive. The therapeutic approach to asthmatic children and adults is constantly changing. For this exam, it is important to be well versed in the current pharmacologic changes in the management of asthma. For this reason, we have included a discussion of asthma on 2 CDs. Now let's go on to the second patient, Ben, who had malignant hypertension. There were 4 critical actions in this case. 1. Diagnosis, malignant hypertension. 2. Drug therapy with sodium nitroprusside. 3. Close monitoring of blood pressure, arterial line or Dynamap. And 4. Admission. Malignant hypertension can be presumptively diagnosed in the emergency department if 3 criteria are met: a diastolic blood pressure of 130 or more, high-grade retinopathy, that's grade 4, and symptoms of end organ damage. These patients generally complain of chest pain, headache, blurred vision, shortness of breath, or symptoms of uremia. Diagnostic studies reveal cardiac, renal, and/or cerebral impairment. Malignant hypertension is a phase of hypertension characterized by a rapid acceleration of the hypertensive process, resulting in significant end-organ impairment. It may occur in any patient with persistent elevation of blood pressure, or it may be the initial presentation of a hypertensive patient. Encephalopathy may also be associated with malignant hypertension, but not necessarily. Since the blood pressure is a significant clue, the examiner didn't want to give it away in the initial presentation. This is why he had been at the admitting desk rather than in a room with a set of vital signs available. He had the classic presentation of unremitting headache. His comment about his head exploding when he sneezed was also typical of malignant hypertension. Aggravation of the headache with sneezing or coughing is commonly seen in these patients. The candidate also elicited the history of blurred vision, another good clue. Physical exam findings were also consistent with the diagnosis. Marked retinal changes are present in these patients, but the most significant finding is papilledema. The diagnosis cannot be made unless papilledema is present. Hemorrhages, cotton wool patches, and hard exudates may also be present, but papilledema is the key to the diagnosis. In addition, most patients have an enlarged left ventricle with some degree of pump failure. If you'll remember, this patient had rows at the lung bases. Regarding the findings on physical exam, note that the candidate failed to assess Ben's mental status for possible encephalopathy, and he also failed to determine if he was competent to refuse treatment during his physical exam. In addition, the candidate made a presumptive diagnosis based on a single blood pressure reading. A better approach would have been to recheck the blood pressure in both arms, using a large cuff if necessary, after the patient was supine and calmed down. Accurate blood pressure readings are essential. The ECG, chest X-ray, and lab studies all supported the diagnosis. Renal impairment was evidenced by an elevated BUN and creatinine, as well as blood and protein reported in the urinalysis. Additional findings were left ventricular hypertrophy and strain on the ECG and cardiomegaly on the chest X-ray. In the event you are given a case of a patient with malignant hypertension, you will be asked about its pathophysiologic effects. The pathologic change responsible for the findings just described is fibrinoid necrosis of small arterioles. As the blood pressure accelerates, the small arterioles dilate and fluid begins leaking into the tissues. Necrosis ensues in smooth muscles, and this, in combination with the leaking of plasma and fibrin deposition, leads to fibrinoid necrosis. The results of this process are directly visible in the retina. Linear hemorrhages result from leaking capillaries. Flame-shaped hemorrhages result from blood dissecting along nerve fibers. Cotton wool patches are swollen ischemic axons that result from rupture of the small arterioles with subsequent vascular obstruction and ischemia. And hard exudates result from lipid deposits deep in the retina. Malignant hypertension, that is, a diastolic pressure of 130 or more in a symptomatic patient with end-organ impairment, is probably best treated with nitroprusside, especially if there is evidence of congestive heart failure. IV labetalol is an alternative choice that can either be used primarily or reserved for patients who fail to respond to IV nitroprusside. IV labetalol is particularly useful when constant BP monitoring is not available. If malignant hypertension is complicated by pulmonary edema, encephalopathy, or chest pain, the blood pressure should be lowered rather quickly to 30% of pretreatment levels. A reasonable goal time would be 30 to 60 minutes. In this setting, an arterial line should be started and the pressure should be monitored every 5 minutes to make sure the pressure is coming down fast, but not too fast. When an arterial line is in, pressure changes secondary to altered infusion rates are recorded almost instantly, so that both the timeliness and safety of therapy is under greater control. Now, what if you have a patient who has a diastolic pressure less than 130? Well, for one thing, he probably doesn't have malignant hypertension. And unless he has CNS symptoms other than headache or an altered mental status, he probably doesn't have hypertensive encephalopathy either. A diastolic pressure between 115 and 130 is potentially harmful, and the need for appropriate therapy is urgent. But this condition is not a hypertensive emergency. In many cases, the problem is due to noncompliance with medications. These patients' blood pressure should be lowered gradually over 24 to 48 hours, using agents such as labetalol, clonidine, or nifedipine. Very rapid reduction in blood pressure is potentially harmful in these patients and should be avoided. For hypertensive urgencies, an oral preparation is more appropriate. Oral labetalol is an excellent choice. The typical dose regimen is 200 mg PO/BID. Labetalol provides a steady, consistent drop in blood pressure, and it can be used in patients with cerebrovascular disease because it does not reduce cerebral blood flow. It is also safe to use in patients with coronary artery disease since it does not induce reflex tachycardia. And when used in high doses, labetalol is also effective in treating MAOI-induced hypertensive emergencies. Labetalol is contraindicated in patients with asthma, congestive heart failure, severe bradycardia, cardiogenic shock, and heart block other than first degree. It should also be avoided in patients with pheochromocytoma, as its administration in these patients has resulted in the development of paradoxical hypertension. Clonidine is also an excellent choice for the treatment of hypertensive urgencies. Advantages of this agent include the following. It is given orally and lowers the diastolic blood pressure gently and effectively. It can be used in just about any patient, and is an ideal agent for many elderly patients in whom postural hypotension is a concern. Given in therapeutic doses, clonidine does not alter vasomotor reflexes, although postural hypotension may occur if the patient is also taking a diuretic. And finally, clonidine can be used in patients with renal failure because it doesn't induce changes in renal blood flow or glomerular filtration rate. The only drawback to the use of clonidine in the emergency department is that it sometimes takes several hours to attain an adequate response. An oral loading dose of 0.1 to 0.2 mg is given initially, followed by additional doses of 0.1 mg given hourly until the diastolic pressure is below 115 or a maximum dose of 0.7 mg has been given. Malignant hypertension would be a good case for this exam because of the reluctance of the patient to be admitted or of the attending physician to admit him. In this case, the objection to hospitalization came from the patient and the social worker. In my experience, the seriousness of this clinical syndrome is frequently underestimated. Patients are sent home from the emergency department on a prescribed antihypertensive agent, only to return later with an acute MI, renal failure, or a CVA. Always admit these patients. Finally, let's look at Mrs. Jones. Critical actions in this case included the following. 1. Endotracheal intubation. 2. Stabilization with an IV O2 and monitor. 3. Diagnosis and treatment of non-ketotic hyperosmolar hyperglycemic coma. 4. Diagnosis and treatment of hypothermia. And 5. Diagnosis and treatment of urosepsis. Other appropriate actions would be the following. Administration of glucose and Narcan, C-spine immobilization, and a portable lateral C-spine film. These actions are not listed as critical because they were not critical in this particular case. Had this patient been unconscious due to hypoglycemia or a narcotic overdose, or if she had fallen and sustained a C-spine fracture, then these actions would have been critical. Since the candidate didn't know whether these conditions existed, he presumed the possibility and appropriately managed them. Airway management in the field is dependent upon the training level of the particular unit transporting your patient. Most intermediate and all advanced units are equipped and the personnel trained for endotracheal intubation. Most basic units are not. This will change in the coming years as use of the combo tube and laryngeal mask airway devices are studied in the pre-hospital setting. To date, most basic units have only nasopharyngeal and oropharyngeal airways in their rigs. Whenever any unconscious patient arrives in the emergency department, always perform an immediate airway assessment, even if the patient has been intubated endotracheally in the field. If you don't, I can almost guarantee that the examiner will create an airway problem in this patient. For example, if the advanced EMTs bring in a patient they have intubated tracheally, and you don't check breath sounds in the first minute or so, the examiner is likely to create a problem, such as tube placement in the right mainstem bronchus. The patient presented with slightly depressed vital signs as well as an altered level of consciousness. The candidate did not know why the patient was hypotensive and bradycardic with mild respiratory depression, but rule number one was in his mind, so he stabilized this patient with an IV and monitor after intubating her. He should have told the respiratory technician to put her on a ventilator, and he should have designated the ventilator settings. Had the examiner wanted to make a point of this, he probably would have asked the candidate if he wanted her back on oxygen, or did he want the respiratory technician to do anything else. But if you think of it first, if you're managing this patient, it just makes you look that much better in the eyes of the examiner. Little things like this tell the examiner you are in control and that you know what you're doing. Clues to the diagnosis of hypothermia were present throughout this case. The first clue was the vital signs. Hypotension, sinus bradycardia, and respiratory depression are seen in patients with mild to moderate hypothermia. The second clue surfaced when the candidate checked the radial pulse. The examiner volunteered the information that the wrist felt cool. The candidate wasn't sure what this information meant. His first thought was that there might be an injury to the extremity with vascular compromise. But the examiner reported negative findings in this respect, but he also reported coolness again on physical exam. Had the candidate checked the contralateral extremity, he would have found the same thing. The third clue was provided by the EMT, who revealed that the patient was found in a cold environment. Since the candidate still hadn't picked up the clues, the examiner reported that the patient was shivering. The candidate finally caught on and ordered a rectal temp to be taken. A core temp between 93.2 and 96.8 is classified as mild hypothermia. 86 to 91.4 is moderate, and less than 86 degrees is severe. Mrs. Jones was mildly hypothermic and required only a warm environment and a blanket. This is safe, slow, and the most appropriate method if hypothermia develops slowly and has been present for some time. Mrs. Jones' clinical presentation met these criteria. I'd like to mention here that, to the best of my knowledge, severe hypothermia, that is, a rectal temp less than 86 degrees, has not yet appeared on this exam, but it could. A review of core rewarming techniques is a good idea. Another possible scenario is the arrested patient with severe hypothermia. Since these arrests are managed differently than the normothermic arrests, it wouldn't hurt to review this topic as well. Now let's get back to Mrs. Jones. About the time the candidate suspected hypothermia, he was also given clues to a second diagnosis, hyperosmolar hyperglycemic coma. He was told that the patient hadn't been feeling well for several days and had complained of urinary frequency to her neighbor. One of the most common causes of non-ketotic hyperosmolar hyperglycemic coma is pyelonephritis, so this was a significant clue as to the etiology. The diagnosis of HHC is made by laboratory analysis. These patients typically have a high serum glucose, more than 600 milligrams per cent and usually greater than 1,000 milligrams per cent, along with a high serum osmolarity level, 350 or higher. The diagnosis is confirmed by the absence of ketosis and acidosis. While insulin administration is obviously indicated, potassium supplementation is also recommended in patients with HHC and should be initiated within 2 hours of administration of IV fluids and insulin, or as soon as adequate renal function has been confirmed. In addition to repleting potassium stores and correcting hypokalemia, supplemental potassium is also believed to help transport insulin intracellularly. Mrs. Jones' initial UTI most likely evolved into pyelonephritis and sepsis with the onset of HHC. Since this was a complicated UTI in a seriously ill patient, IV therapy with a quinolone, such as ciprofloxacin or norfloxacin, was appropriate and the initial treatment of choice in this situation. Adjustments in therapy can be made later when culture and sensitivity results are available. As you listen to the last part of this case simulation, the wrap-up appears sloppy. In a rather haphazard fashion, the candidate searches for evidence of injury, and he never performs a complete neuro exam. A detailed injury check and neuro exam would have been unrevealing in this patient. Had there been positive findings in either of these areas, the candidate would have been in serious trouble. In this case, however, the examiner allowed it because he was bringing the case to a close. Because the candidate had met all of the critical actions, the examiner made his move to close the case by asking the candidate if he wanted to speak to Mrs. Jones' family doctor. This point is mentioned in the text under Case Management Techniques. I'll paraphrase it for you here. Because of time constraints, the examiner may have you finalize case management before a complete H&P is done. If time permits, do it. If the examiner is signaling you to end the case, then forget it. This concludes the analysis of the multiple encounter. I want to spend a few moments now talking to you about the multiple encounter itself. You will have two of these as part of your exam, and one multiple encounter simulation must be passed in order to pass the oral exam. But don't let this worry you. Most of the physicians I've talked to didn't find it too difficult, and neither did I. As long as you follow the examiner's leads, you should do very well. He'll help you move from patient to patient, and for the most part, he'll provide diagnostic and therapeutic clues for each patient. There is an exceptional circumstance, however, that needs to be mentioned. If you are dealing with a life or limb-threatening illness or injury that requires your complete attention, the examiner may try to divert your attention with another patient. Do not follow him if this situation exists. If he tries to divert you with a patient who is clinically stable, tell the examiner that you will see the patient as soon as you can, but that for the moment you can't leave the patient you are now attending. Now, if the examiner tries to divert you with an unstable patient, the right decision is more difficult to make. If this happens, ask yourself these questions. Which patient can benefit most from my expertise? Which patient could benefit most from the expertise of another specialist? And can an RN assist with the problem? Let me give you some sample scenarios with possible solutions. Let's say you are managing an MI patient who is unstable. You're interrupted by a nurse who says the obstetrician is on the phone and wants to talk to you. You had put a call in for him earlier because you also have a patient with an ectopic pregnancy. What would you do? The simplest solution is to ask the nurse to talk to him. She can explain why you can't come to the phone, tell him that you have a patient with an ectopic pregnancy, and ask that he come in to see the patient. Now let's say that instead of a stable ectopic, you have an unstable one, and you're still dealing with the unstable MI. The nurse comes in and says your ectopic is in shock, blood pressure 90 over 60 with a thready pulse. What would you do now? What the patient needs is shock therapy, mass trousers and two large bore IV lines with rapid fluid infusion, and blood should be given as soon as it's available. All of this can be accomplished by the nursing staff. At the same time, you can have the admitting clerk page for an obstetrician that might be in the hospital. If there is none, have her contact the one on call. Managing the situation this way allows you to stay with the unstable MI patient who requires your presence as well as your expertise. A third possible scenario is this. What if you have two unstable MIs, both of which require your presence and expertise? The first thing you should do is make sure that both patients are stabilized with an IV, O2, pulse oximeter, and cardiac monitor. Have the admitting clerk page an internist or family practitioner that may be in the hospital. If no one answers the page, then the internist on call should be contacted and should be asked to come in immediately. In the meantime, you will have to move back and forth quickly between these two patients, conducting rapid assessments, initiating treatment, and evaluating the efficacy of your treatment. I think that if you handle any of these situations in the manner I've described, the examiner will consider your management appropriate. This CD concludes the case studies. You may have noticed that except for the asthma patient, all the other patients fell into one of the 9 case categories discussed earlier, and all 9 topics were covered in these case studies. The cases were presented in a style that is consistent with the actual exam process. For the most part, the candidates in these cases did a pretty good job. Any errors or imperfections in their performances were noted in the analysis of each case. But I think they would have passed had these cases been real rather than simulated. As you re-listen to these cases, I'd like you to notice how the candidates adhered to the 4 rules and how they stuck to a management plan. As a matter of fact, it wouldn't be a bad idea if you set aside 20 or 30 minutes a day at your home and listen to a case with the rules and management plan written down in front of you. That way, you can mentally check off the rules and management steps as you hear them. It would also help reinforce the rules and management plan in your mind. If you listen to the case simulations a third time, then I would recommend that you just listen to them passively. In other words, listen to the process, not the content. After all, it's the process that's important. The cases will change, but the process will be the same. If you're feeling a little fatigued about now, take a deep breath and relax. You've covered a lot of material so far, but you're getting there. Just stay with me a little while longer, and you'll be ready when the time comes. This is the end of the 5th CD.